election, hours for the wives, and hours for the children. We have just a nice neighborly chat before we came to the point of our visit. Eventually, the ice was broken, so Mr. Bates said, "Now you tell this man that he is going to hear a very marvelous story which I will tell him. This is the story of the two roads." Now, if I so had heard that story before, in fact, he had heard it several times. But Navajos are always courteous, always considerate and patient. So he sat there on the sheepskin, his face like a mask, and showing no annoyance or disapproval. So, sitting there cross-legged on the dirt floor, Albert Bates drew a straight line in the sand with his forefingers, and he said, "Now, this is the straight road, and it's a narrow road. And the man who walks on this road is a good man. He's a man who doesn't lie. He's a man who doesn't steal. He's a man who doesn't gamble." And he looks straight at Abishai's self, "And he's a man who has no more than one wife." Now, when this man comes to the end of the road and dies, his body is buried, and his soul goes far up into the sky. Way up there in the blue heavens, it comes to a gate, a huge gate that is made of precious stones and pearls. He walks through that gate, and there before him is a city, with streets paved with pure gold. And along those streets of pure gold are huge, fine, handsome mansions. One of these mansions is given to this good man, and he lives in that mansion forever. Now, he never dies. He is in eternity, and he goes on living in that house forever. There was a long pause while Albert Bates prepared for the second part of his story. So, reaching down, he drew a zigzag, meandering line in the sand, and said, "Now here is another road, the crooked road, the road that is traveled by a man who is not a good man. He is a man who lies. He is a man who steals. He is a man who gambles. And he is a man who has more than one wife. And when that man comes to the end of the road and dies, his body is buried in the ground, but his soul goes far below, down into a huge pit filled with fire. And there, in that fiery furnace, he burns, he fries, he sizzles, and he roasts forever and ever and ever." Albert Bates paused for a time, and we all sat there in silence. And our friend, our good host, Abishai Stowe, gazed intently at those two lines in the sand, the straight road and the crooked road. At last, Albert Bates put to him the crucial question, asking which one of those two roads he wants to travel. After considering the question another 2 or 3 minutes, Abishai Stowe said, "I don't think I can travel that straight road. In fact, I don't think I could even get on it. It is so narrow and so straight that it just wouldn't do for a man like me to go over that kind of a road. At the same time, this crooked road is not the kind of a road I ever travel. That is the way a snake travels, and snakes are evil. I think the best way for me to travel is just to walk between those two roads." I saw an expression of sadness come over Albert Bates' face. He was very unhappy because his message had been burned and his time wasted. And perhaps, just possibly, this encounter with Abishai's soul was one of the reasons why, within a year or two, He abandoned his missionary activities and went into the trading business. This is the story of the wayward husband. There seems to be a general belief that the American Indian woman is a humble, passive, self-effacing individual who is a faithful servant to her husband, obedient to his authority, and above all, never dares to criticize his personal behavior at home or abroad. This may indeed be true of some of the many tribes that inhabit North America, but the Navajo woman is not cut from such a pattern. Back in 1904, when I was living on the Navajo reservation, I witnessed an incident that made this fact crystal clear to all concerned. About half a mile from our house was located the Hogan, a trusting deceased guy. He was a man in his middle 30s. His wife was about his age, and they had three children. We had made their acquaintance 4 years previously when we first settled on the site that was later to be called Torchaco. They were our closest neighbors and frequently paid us a visit. Occasionally, we bought a mutton from them. In short, we came to know them very well. They appeared to be an average, run-of-the-mill Navajo family. Then, on a certain day, Huskeen between the five showed up at our place in a frightful condition. He appeared to have been the victim of aggravated assault. His face was badly bruised and covered with blood. One eye was closed, and there were purple welts on the backs of his hands. My mother heated some water on our wood stove, brought out her medical supplies, and went to work on him. She washed off all the blood and applied disinfectant and emollient salve that would accelerate the healing process on the braided skin and bruised flesh. Naturally, my mother was very sympathetic, as she wanted to know all the details of his mishap. He told her that he was riding a locoed horse over ground that was strewn with malachi, lava fragments with sharp angles that could cut like a knife. He was just riding along, relaxed in the saddle, when suddenly, and without warning, the horse had been transformed into a devil with four legs. Instantly, he was propelled skyward from the saddle and landed on those sharp rocks. Preoccupied with her concern over his injuries and the task of alleviating them, my mother failed at the moment to note anything strange or incredible about his story. All those injuries had plainly been caused by a blunt instrument of some kind. They were definitely not the sort that would be brought about by violent contact with sharp rocks. Then, in the days that followed, fragmentary reports came in, and when they were assembled, she knew the whole story. Huskeen the Pink of Pie had developed a roving eye that eventually fell on a young widow who lived a few miles distant from his hogan. After a brief and surreptitious courtship, he had won the young widow's heart and decided to abandon his lawful spouse for this younger and more attractive mistress. But in the days that followed, somehow the grapevine carried the rumor to his wife. Her sharp eyes finally noted that he was furtively removing his belongings meal from their hogan. Then one day, without preamble or explanation, she armed herself with a heavy, braided, rawhide quirt. It was a formidable weapon, having a knob at the top. Grasping the small end, she confronted that wayward husband and launched into her violent assault, punctuating her charges of base infidelity with blows to the head, face, and torso. Taken by surprise, the man was utterly defenseless, and when the castigation was completed, all designs for abandoning his wife had come to an end. 8 years later, when we left Old Chaco and moved to Indian Wells, the marriage bond between this couple was still very firm indeed. Our story now moves ahead for a quarter of a century. I had left the reservation and taken up my residence in California, where I was employed as a civil engineer by the city of Los Angeles. In the summer of 1929, I was spending my vacation in northern Arizona. While I was staying in Flagstaff, I met my friend Harry Carr, a columnist and feature writer for the Los Angeles Times, who was touring the southwestern states. Harry had an avid interest in the Navajo Indians, and I offered to take him on a trip over the reservation. We drove out to Tocheco, where the buildings were all abandoned and in ruins. There were other changes since we left Tocheco. Many of my good friends had passed away, and the youngsters I knew in the old days had grown up and were approaching middle age. We visited several home runs, and Harry was constantly taking down notes. Eventually, we arrived at a home run about 5 miles from the ruins of Tocheco. Inside, we found an elderly couple whom I recognized instantly. They were my old friends. Seemed to see the fire and his wife. She was weaving a rug and turned around to greet me when I entered. On the way out from Flagstaff, I had told Harry the story of his unfaithfulness. And when I informed him that this was the same couple, still living together, a faint smile flickered across his face. Our reunion was very pleasant indeed. We discussed the events of years gone by, and the personalities we have known so well. Finally, the tree of fire asked, "Kadosh Arvo, where are you going from here?" I answered, "Yoki Sanovo, we are going to Flagstaff." Then he asked, "May I go with you?" I answered, "Yes, certainly." Reaching under a pile of sheepskin, he pulled out a sack and started to take out his best clothes. Then his wife spoke a few words. They were barely audible, and I failed to grasp their meaning. Instantly, her husband's hands froze, and after a few seconds, he put his clothes back in the sack. When we had finished our visit, we rose to go, and I said to the signifier, "Come along, we're going to Flagstaff." He answered, "I'm not going with you." "Why not?" I asked. There was a brief pause before he answered. Then, with downcast eyes and a sad expression on his face, he answered, "The woman, she said, no." This story is titled, "A Hunting Expedition with the Navajo." Perhaps the most vivid of all recollections of my life with the Navajos are those of the hunting trips I took with them after the turn of the century. There was a very special reason why they wanted me to accompany them on their trips. In the first place, these trips were absolutely necessary in order to procure two items that were prime necessities to them, pinon nuts and buckskin. The latter was especially desirable because in those days the Navajos had not adapted themselves to the white man's footgear. But the main reason why they felt that my company was essential on these trips was that I could act as a shock absorber, a peacemaker in case they met white men out in the field at the same time. They had a very good reason for this. In November 1899, a party of Navajos were out on one of their annual hunts along the rim of Canyon Padre, a few miles north of Anderson Mesa. While they were in camp one evening, just before sundown, a posse of white men came in with a bogus warrant which they tried to serve on one of the party on a trumped-up charge of horse stealing. They came into the camp. None of them spoke one word of Navajo, and there was no Navajo present who spoke a word of English. So one of this party pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket and read from it a few sentences which were absolutely unintelligible to the Navajos, and replaced the paper in his pocket. Then he gave a signal to the other members of the party, and they all made a rush for the Navajo's rifles, which were leaning against the shelters of juniper branches that they had constructed as a windbreak. This immediately precipitated a fight. Many shots were fired. Two Navajos were killed, and there were a number of wounded on both sides. In September of the following year, 1900, these Navajos were tried in Flagstaff on a charge of first-degree murder, but they were acquitted when the evidence proved that they had been attacked by the white man and acted in self-defense. For several years following this bloody affair, the Navajos felt, when they went on their hunting trip, that they were going into hostile territory, and they were fearful of the consequences of meeting unfriendly white men. Therefore, they asked me on several occasions to accompany them. In November 1907, I joined one of these hunting expeditions, which turned out to be the most adventurous and hazardous undertaking I have ever shared with the Navajos. There were about a dozen in the party, which included women and children. The latter would be very helpful in gathering pinon nuts. We had one wagon in which five or six women rode, and the remainder of us traveled on horseback. Our point of departure was Tolochaco, and the first night we made camp about 20 miles to the south. The next day we crossed the railroad at Angel Station and continued south for about 12 or 14 miles in the vicinity of Anderson Mesa. We made camp late that afternoon and built a shelter of juniper boughs to fend off the wind, which was blowing rather briskly. The next morning we had breakfast before sunrise. Three of our party went out to see if they could find some deer, and the rest of us started to gather pinon nuts. But shortly after we had started to gather these nuts, snow began to fall. Within an hour, the ground was covered to such an extent that we couldn't pick the nuts off the ground. It began to look as though we'd go home empty-handed, so far as the pinon nuts were concerned. We held a little council, and one of the men suggested that we hunt wood rat nests, which always held a quantity of nuts that the wood rats had stored for the winter. We were cautioned that these nuts belonged to the wood rat, and when we took any of them, the wood rat would be sharing his property with us involuntarily. So we must never take more than one half of the nuts he had stored and leave enough for him to avoid starvation for the remainder of the winter. So we all took gunny sacks and deployed through the forest for the remainder of the day. Each nest we found yielded one or two handfuls of nuts. When we all assembled at camp that evening, the total cake was just about half a gunny sack full of nuts. We cooked our meal over a campfire that evening, and after an hour or two beside the fire, we rolled up in our beds. I had two sheepskins, which made a very comfortable mattress, and one quilt and a blanket. When I first went to bed, I felt rather chilly. I could have used some more covers, but I soon went to sleep, and as the night progressed, with my head under the covers, I seemed to become warmer and warmer. Finally, when I woke up next morning, with my head still under the covers, I was very warm and snug. Then, when I pushed the covers off my head, I discovered the reason for all that warmth. I was locked under 30 inches of snow. With my hands, I pushed the snow away from my body, and when this excavation finally reached the surface, I sat up, and my eyes came just even with the surface of the snow. And sitting there in my bed, and in the snow, I saw an amazing sight. The Navajos were first to appear out of that deep, white blanket. They had slept in part of their clothes. And the first thing they did was to take off the rest of their clothing, right down to their G-string. Then they took a run through the snow, racing and running and falling down in the snow and rolling over repeatedly. They looked over and saw my head just above the top of the snow, and then they began to talk me. Come on, get out here and join us, they shouted. But I just sat there and shivered. Then, at the final bar, one of them yelled at me, "Just in the sun is open, Mirida, in the Egypt. You are not a white man, you are a Navajo." That was more than I could take. I sprang out of bed, stripped off the undergarments in which I had slept, and went out to join them, minus a G-string, of course. But since the ladies were still deep under that white blanket, I did so without any embarrassment. Finally, when we had finished our violent exercise, after a few minutes, we went back to our bed and groped around for our garments under the snow. Eventually, we got them on, and then we went over to the loose side of a large juniper tree where the snow was not so deep, and cleared off an area large enough to accommodate our party. The women and children finally joined us, and we cooked our breakfast, consisting of non-starchy bread, broiled mutton, and coffee. The snowstorm had brought our quest for pinon nuts and venison to a sudden and untimely end. Now our problem was twofold: survival and escape from nature's trap in which we were caught. The snow reached up to the breasts of our horses and to the running gear of the wagon, and we had only one team to pull that wagon. We had 8 saddle horses, and the riders formed in 2 lines of 4 each, with a space between them which was the width of the wagon track. This formation rode ahead to break a trail through the snow. Our progress was extremely difficult and painfully slow. The team pulling the wagon was strained to the utmost, and we had to stop frequently and allow them to rest. At the end of the first day, we had covered less than 2 miles. Our provisions were running low. We had plenty of coffee, we had plenty of flour and baking powder to make non-starchy bread, but we had only enough mutton for 1 meal. As we rode along, we frequently encountered jackrabbits, which had been trapped by this deep snow. These rabbits were unable to run away from us. They could only jump up and down frantically in one spot. So we took clubs, rode over to them with our horses, dispatched them, and threw them into the wagon. That night, we built a large fire, and when it burned down to coals and ashes, we scooped out a hollow in the embers and threw in about a dozen jackrabbits and roasted them in the coals with the skins on for about 30 minutes. At first, the meat was tolerable, but we were obliged to eat it for 6 days, and my stomach almost turned a somersault when it was forced to receive that last meal. To this day, the sight of a jackrabbit loping across the desert produces an involuntary spasm in my stomach. On the third day, we treed a porcupine, which we roasted in the coals. And after all that jackrabbit meat, the porcupine was delicious. On the first day of the deep snow, I ran into serious trouble. The shoes I was wearing were just ordinary footgear designed for dry weather. They soon became completely waterlogged, and my feet were almost frozen. The Navajos became aware of my plight, and that evening they made a pair of moccasins from one of the sheepskins with the fleece inside. They were enormous creatures, just about half again the width of ordinary shoes. But they were completely waterproof and luxuriously warm. Those nights after the big storm had turned so bitterly cold that it was necessary for us to sleep in one common bed, huddled together and depending on our bodily warmth to keep us alive through the night when the temperature hovered around 0. After 6 days of toiling and struggling through that deep snow, we finally reached the railroad at Angel Station late in the afternoon and made camp. After some discussion among themselves, the Navajos decided to pool all the money they had with them and send me to Flagstaff on the train to buy supplies. I had brought no money myself, and they had nothing but silver coins. However, it added up to several dollars. Each of them gave me his money and told me what he wanted me to buy. The next morning, a freight train pulled into Angel Station and stopped to take on water for the locomotive. I went back to the caboose and climbed aboard. The conductor glanced at me in wonderment. Here was a 15-year-old boy, somewhat undersized, in tattered clothes and wearing huge Belgian moccasins. I asked him what the fare was to Flagstaff. But first, he wanted to know who I was and how I came to be in that location. So I explained to him that I had been out hunting with a party of Navajos, that we had been snowbound, and it took us 6 days to return to the railroad. And I asked him again what the fare was to Flagstaff. He looked me over for a moment and then said, "Well, son, we'll just carry you to Flagstaff without any fare." So finally the train pulled out, and within an hour we were in Flagstaff. I got off the caboose and went to the Babbitt Brothers Trading Company. Each Navajo had given me a list of what he wanted. My memory was pretty fair, and I managed to get them all just about what they had ordered. So I put the merchandise in two gunny sacks, tied the tops of the gunny sacks together, and threw them over my shoulder. As I walked down the street, I noticed that almost everyone stared at me with astonishment and turned around to look at me after I passed. I was certainly a strange sight in those tattered clothes, huge moccasins, and loaded gunny sacks over my shoulder. At the depot, I bought a ticket to Angel Station and got on a train later that afternoon. When I returned to our camp, we were really well fixed for supplies from that time on. We had some canned goods, fresh meat, some American bread, and a number of other luxury items. The rest of our trip was more or less uneventful. Continuing northward, we dropped to a lower elevation where there was little snow on the ground. Within 2 days, we had returned to Tolchaco, not too much the worse for wear, considering all we had been through. We had only half a sack of pinon nuts to show for our long and arduous trip, a trip that I will remember for the rest of my life. It was a strange sequence of events that led me, a boy 9 years of age, into the White House for an interview with President Theodore Roosevelt 1 month after he had taken office following the death of President McKinley. It all came about as a result of the chaotic condition of land tenure in Arizona. At that time, in 1901, most of northern Arizona was either railroad land or public domain. The Navajo Indians had occupied public domain land bordering their reservation for generations without having a title to such land. Meantime, white people had settled up the northern part of the territory. They had brought large herds of cattle into Arizona, and they were expanding their operations and crowding Navajos off of rangeland, which, as I say, they had occupied for generations. And so it was that my father took a hand and tried to prevent the eviction of these Navajos from their ancestral homeland. He had the counsel and the help of the Indian Rights Association, which had offices in Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. On the advice of the association, he had compiled a map showing the area south of the Little Colorado River, which had been occupied by the Navajos for well over a century. On this map, he spotted the location of each Navajo family occupying the area, which the white men were trying to take by pressuring the Navajos and threatening them, and using other means of evicting them from their homes. The Indian Rights Association suggested that he make a census of these families, showing on the map as accurately as he could how long those lands had been occupied by the Navajos. So my father went into the preparation of this map. He spent several months working it up, showing the locations of each family and the number of individuals in that family. It was the plan of the Indian Rights Association to arrange for an interview with the President of the United States, who at that time was William McKinley. We had our map just about finished and ready to start for Washington when news came to us that President McKinley, while visiting the Pan-American Exposition in Buffalo, was shaking hands with the crowd, and a young Polish anarchist who was in the crowd with a bandaged hand came up to him. And it proved that this bandage on his right hand contained a small revolver with which he shot the President twice in the stomach. That was on the 4th of September, 1901. And 10 days later, on September 14th, my birthday, President McKinley passed away. Immediately, he was succeeded by the then Vice President, Theodore Roosevelt. Now, we had never heard much about Vice President Roosevelt. We knew a little about him. We had read that he had been a rancher in North Dakota as a young man, and then, in later years, he had gone into politics in the state of New York, where he had been a police commissioner at one time in New York City, and finally had been elected governor of the state of New York. And then, during the Spanish-American War, he had won quite a little renown by commanding a regiment known as the Rough Riders, recruited largely from the southwestern states, and had covered himself with glory by the charge of San Juan Hill. Now, that's all we knew about the Vice President, except that he was a rather young man. He was only 43 years old. So with this knowledge in mind about the new young President, we started for Washington. My father selected two Navajos to accompany him, whose names were Jeanette Yardley and Septimus Stewart, and I went along to act as interpreter. We stayed at the Beveridge Hotel, just off of Pennsylvania Avenue, and the Indian Rights Association had arranged for an appointment with the new President. So, on the day this appointment took place, we went to the White House and were guided to the waiting room, where we entered and found a large number of people waiting to see the President. We took chairs, and after we had been there for a few minutes, the President's secretary came out of the office and announced to the people waiting there that he would have no time to give any interviews. However, he would come out in a few minutes and shake hands with each person in the room. At that point, my father rose and said, "You'll pardon me, sir. I have come 2,500 miles with two Navajo Indians, and we have been working for this appointment for several weeks. We had this appointment confirmed a number of days ago, and were notified that the appointment was in order. Now, if the President is unable to see us, then there will be no point in my remaining here merely to shake hands with him, so I might just as well take the Navajos that I brought with me and leave." The secretary was very much impressed, and he said, "Well, sir, will you please wait a minute until I go back and see the President?" So we went back into the office and finally returned to the room and said, "The President will see you in a few minutes." So within perhaps 10 minutes, we were ushered into the inner office, and there we saw the new President seated behind a large desk. My father went over to him and introduced himself. Then he introduced the Navajos. "This is Tachini T," and Tachini T shook hands with the President. "And this is Dinesh Yaji," and Dinesh Yaji shook hands with him. "And this is my son Philip." And the President ruffled my hair and said, "Hello, Philip." So that was my interview with President Theodore Roosevelt. Now I had some duties to perform. My father told his story. He spread out his map on the President's desk and pointed out to him where these Navajos had lived for decades. for periods long before the white men had come into the country. And then the first had asked questions of these two Navajos that had accompanied us, which I interpreted to the Navajos, and then interpreted their answers to the president. I don't think our interview lasted as much as 10 minutes, maybe as much as 8 minutes. It was very intensive. The president was busy and he came right to the point. But he gave us enough time to tell our story. And then he thanked us for coming in. He was very gracious and very kind. And when we took our departure, we had a strong impression that he was on our side. A week later, we had returned to our home in Arizona. And a short time after our arrival, word came from the Commissioner of Indian Affairs that the President had issued an executive order withdrawing all the land in dispute from sale and settlement, which gave the Navajos an immediate and temporary safeguard of their rights. Then, after further investigation, which disclosed that my father's information had been completely factual, President Roosevelt issued another executive order extending the Navajo Reservation to include this land. It was a triangular area containing about 330 square miles. Today, it is known as the Loop Extension to the Navajo Reservation. In the years that followed, Theodore Roosevelt became immortal in history as a great statesman, a champion of justice, and a friend to underprivileged and downtrodden people. And I shall always remember that hand that ruffled my hair and the cheerful, hearty voice that said, "Hello, Philip." The title of this story is Operation Aircraft. Ever since the Pilgrims disembarked from the good ship Mayflower and landed on the coast of Massachusetts, there have been many schemes, many plans proposed to speed up the process of civilizing the American Indians. Some of them have produced results. Others have been fantastic and impractical. Perhaps the worst of these nostrums was an order issued by Commissioner of Indian Affairs Jones in Washington back in 1902 that all male Indians in the United States should have their hair cut short. To him, the long hair of an Indian was a symbol of savagery. Remove that, and he believed that a long step would be taken towards civilizing the savages. Now that order went out to every Indian agency in the United States, to every center of power under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. At that time, my father was the acting superintendent of the Loop Extension, south of the Little Colorado River. His official title was a mouth-filling one, Additional Farmer and Special Dispersing Agent. The commissioner's letter came to him one day in the mail, and he simply shrugged, threw it in the wastebasket, and forgot about it. Of course, he realized the consequences of failing or refusing to carry out an order from higher authority might mean that he would be separated from his job. But he decided that if the commissioner wanted to make an issue of it, he wouldn't wait to be discharged. He would simply leave the service. For after all, he wasn't interested in that particular position. His primary interest as a missionary was to save the souls of the Navajos, and also as a friend, to protect them against the incursions of white men who had been trying to crowd them off their land. At any rate, that letter went into the wastebasket, and he more or less forgot about it. In the weeks that followed, reports on the progress of this plan to civilize the Navajos filtered into our community. Blue Canyon had acknowledged the order and promised to put it into effect, quote, as soon as feasible, end quote. Fort Defiance had temporized in a similar vein. But the superintendent at Kings Canyon made no reply. He was a long-time career man, a resolute, decisive person who always carried out orders enthusiastically and to the letter. His exploit in dealing with this situation caused a deep niche in Arizona's history. At that time, Kings Canyon was the administrative center of the Hopi Reservation and the central portion of the Navajo Reservation. Its police force was a half a dozen Navajos without uniforms, whose authority was proclaimed by the badges they wore. Summoning them to his office, superintendent read the order slowly, and it was translated, sentence by sentence, to an interpreter. For several minutes after the reading was finished, the policemen sat in complete silence, their faces utterly impassive. Finally, a spokesman for the group ventured an opinion, counseled in diplomatic language. That order was not a good one. It would be resented and resisted by all Indians under King Canyon's authority. Whereupon, the superintendent delivered a scathing lecture. It was their duty as officers of the law to carry out the commissioner's orders. If they were unwilling to do so, they could turn in their badges forthwith and revert to civilian status. The silence that followed was long and embarrassing. At last, the spokesman offered a suggestion. Why not try it on the Hopis first? If all went well with them, then perhaps the Navajos might be persuaded to follow suit, and everybody would be happy. That, replied the superintendent, was a splendid idea, one to be carried out immediately. However, as plans matured, it was discovered that Kings Canyon's supply of barber tools were inadequate for the project. One set was in constant use by the boarding school. The other set was the property of an employee who was the community's only barber, who was obliged to maintain dependable service for his regular clientele. But the problem was quickly solved. Sheep shears were in abundant supply on the reservation. From the very start, the Hopis proved to be recalcitrant and uncooperative. For generations, their contacts with the Navajos had frequently been marked by animosity and occasionally by open warfare. So when a Navajo policeman proposed to cut a Hopi hair, the reaction was violently negative. So, all attempts at persuasion having failed, the police force was organized in teams of three officers each, two to pin the victim's arms, while a third went to work with the sheep shears and reduced the victim's hair to specified standards. Lacking the skill of the barber and the tools of his trade, these policemen turned out some haircuts that would have been monstrous even on a scarecrow. But for a time, these Navajos had some rare sport hunting down their Hopi victims. They waylaid them in trading posts, stalked them in their fields, and ambushed them along roads and trails. Within a few days, every Hopi on the reservation had been alerted, and those with hair still intact retreated to the fastness of their ancient villages, high on the summits of lofty mesas, which had long served as strongholds against the forays of predatory tribes. Reporting their progress, the police informed the superintendent that the quarry was well fortified, with huge boulders poised above the narrow trails leading to their villages. A strong well-armed force would be required to breach their defenses. Perhaps it would be wise to send for the army. That, replied the superintendent, was not the best way to handle the situation. Eventually, those hopers would find it necessary to come down off the mesa, at which time they could be dealt with effectively. Meanwhile, the police would devote their attention to the Navajos. That should be a simple matter, since they lived in small, isolated groups. Again, there was a long and ominous silence, followed by protest that the Navajos might be goaded into hostility by such high-handed tactics. Once again, the superintendent stood his ground and delivered a stern lecture on the duties and obligations of policemen, as well as the urgency of obeying orders from Washington. Indeed, a refusal to carry out such orders might well result in serious consequences. Lashed by his tirade, the constabulary filed out of the office, mounted their horses, and departed from King's Canyon. For several days, peace and harmony prevailed at this far outpost of the national authority. Life went on as usual. The trading post bought its average quota of wool, hides, and Navajo rugs, and sold the customary staples, flour, sugar, coffee, and a few canned items. Then it became evident that Navajos were arriving in augmented numbers. They pitched their camps along the canyon shores and on the surrounding hills. By day, their wagons were still wetted against the skyline. By night, campfires shed a soft glow over the buildings of the agency. Obviously, something was afoot. The agency interpreter, circulating through the camps to glean information, learned nothing. He was met by silence or non-committal answers to his questions. Finally, the word got around that council was to be on a certain night. Its locale was to be on a high ridge overlooking the canyon. Firewood was piled high, and on the appointed night, faggots blazed. More than 1,000 Navajos surrounded that huge bonfire. One after another, orators expressed their feelings about that order that had come out of Washington. Relays of reporters carried bulletins of the council's trend to the superintendent, who remained cloistered in his office. These reports were not reassuring. There was unanimous agreement that this order was bad. 34 years ago, in 1868, the Navajos had signed a treaty with Washington, promising to live in peace with the white men for all time. There was nothing in that treaty, absolutely nothing, that required the Navajos to have their hair cut short. This order was contrary to all public interest and should not be obeyed. There, perhaps, the matter should have rested, but the fire was bright. Stars blazed overhead, and feeling ran high. Quite naturally, the council's momentum carried it far beyond its prime objective. With growing absurdity, speakers brought out the contrast between the